From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hurricane Michael is barreling toward the Florida Panhandle, where Governor Rick Scott has issued evacuation orders for 120,000 people living along the coast. Georgia Governor Nathan Deal issued emergency declarations for 92 Georgia counties for a potentially catastrophic storm. As the Category 4 storm nears, Marshall Shepard, he's director of UGA's Atmospheric Sciences Program, is tracking it. And Marshall, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what a day. Update us on what Michael is doing now.
Well, this is unprecedented, and I don't say that in a hyped or exaggerated sense. If this storm stays at Category 4 with 145-mile-per-hour winds, it will be the first time this part of Florida has seen this type of storm. And I am seeing devastation along the coastal regions of the Panhandle, wind damage along the Panhandle from Panama City to Tallahassee, and even for Georgians, they have to pay attention to this storm because it's so strong. It's not going to ramp down for quite a while. So parts of southern Georgia could see hurricane-strength winds.
Well, Marshall, oftentimes, as you said, if this storm stays, oftentimes do hurricanes intensify or lose steam after making landfall?
Yeah, I think we're kind of beyond that. This is going to be a Cat 4 storm. I just kind of was in the habit of saying that. This storm is locked and loaded, I believe, at Cat 4. Frankly, there are even signs that it's intensifying even a bit more at this time. So it's only a few hours from landfall at this point. So I think the Panhandle of Florida is going to be dealing with a Category 4 storm, and they've never seen anything like that. And that's dangerous because people can't kind of fathom what they've not experienced.
Mm. Well, Weather Channel crews, we just received word, have evacuated from the coast. Is this much worse than expected?
Well, I think all week we've been talking about the possibility of a major storm, Category 3 or higher, but the rapid intensification to Category 4, I think, caught all of us a bit off guard, but it was certainly within the realm of some of what some of our models are hinting at even 2 or 3 days ago.
Well, tell us about the models. Why are hurricanes so much more difficult to predict than land-based storms, for example?
Well, in terms of our track forecast, the hurricanes are fairly easy to predict. We've gotten quite good over the last several decades. The challenge has been the intensity forecast, and that's just because of the things that go on inside these big heat engines. The internal mechanisms inside the eye wall of the storm. We don't necessarily have all the observations to get at those internal mechanisms. The track forecasting is better because they're governed more by the steering currents that our models do better with.
So what degree of accuracy can meteorologists predict exactly where they will fall and track?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. Yeah, we're well within a range now where our accuracy is within, 50 miles or so on either side of the landfall point. So I'm pretty confident that the Panama City area of Florida is going to be sort of the ground zero for landfall. But then everywhere to the right of that, bad storm surge. But then one of the things for the listeners to remember, hurricanes are not a point on a map. There are impacts well beyond the landfall point.
So, and even now, on the coast of Florida, along the Panhandle, what is happening in terms of weather?
Yeah, we're starting to see the spiral bands rotating in as the storm is still a few hours from landfall. You'll start to see tropical storm force winds, the prospect perhaps of even tornadoes spinning up, and the rainfall will pick up as well. This is a triple threat of storm surge, wind, and rain, and so that really worries me.
Well, people here, of course, have memories of Irma just last fall, and now just weeks after Florence hit the Carolinas. It's interesting because the protocols are chillingly familiar. We hear, people are glued to alerts. They're filling up their tubs or supplies, or some are even determined to ride out the storms. Do you think, Marshall, the frequency of the storms has altered the way that people respond?
I don't. I think that people are still, and I'm seeing that a lot with this storm as I'm monitoring social media. I think people think they're just going to get a little wind and some rain. We're talking about a Category 4 storm for Florida, and even in parts of Georgia, they're going to experience hurricane force and strong tropical force winds from southwestern Georgia all the way over to the eastern side of Georgia near Augusta and Savannah. And so I'm worried that people are sort of underplaying the experience. I see significant power outages, trees down, and wind damage.
So one reason that people say they don't want to leave or evacuate is having pets. And we do have with us Gwen Cooper on the line. She's an author and a pet rescue expert. Hello, Gwen.
Hello.
So what are you thinking of when you hear about these kind of warnings?
Well, you know, of course, what I'm always thinking of are our pet owners, and you are right. A lot of people do choose to try to ride it out in evacuation zones because they don't want to leave their pets. And, of course, often that turns out to be the worst possible move you could make.
So how can pet owners prepare for these kind of natural disasters?
Well, the first thing I want to emphasize, and to an earlier point that was raised, is that, you know, the effects of a hurricane are felt far out from the hurricane center. Even if you're not in an evacuation area, that does not mean that a tornado or some flooding could not hit your area unexpectedly. Certainly, if you are in an evacuation area, you should evacuate. At this point, if you are not able to evacuate with your pets to a shelter that is accepting pets, you know, try to get as far outside of the evacuation zone as you can and find safe harbor. Beyond that, I would advise anybody who stands to be affected by the storm to create a go bag, kind of like they would have for themselves. Make sure you have your pet's important documents, vaccination records, medication if they're taking any, a couple of days' supply of food. If you would need to transport your cat or dog in a carrier, you should certainly have that out and readily accessible. So in a catastrophic moment, you are not first hunting for a mechanism to transport your pet out of danger. And the last thing I always recommend, if you have pets who are prone to hiding, certainly my cats are never happy to get in their carrier. If I were to need to evacuate with them quickly, I would first have to kind of chase them down. So maybe if that applies to you, try to restrict the number of rooms or the areas within your house that your pets have access to during the storm.
How about measures to locate them during or after storms, like microchips, that kind of thing? Do you recommend that?
Absolutely. Microchip. It is the best and easiest way. You know, a lot of times things happen fast, and despite your best preparations or planning, sometimes it is unavoidable that you will be separated from your pet. Microchipping is inexpensive. Any veterinarian can do it for you, and it is the best and easiest way to make sure that you are reunited with your pet after a storm if the two of you are separated.
Marshall, obviously you and your colleagues are warning people about this storm, and we often do get this idea of, you know, storms are big business in terms of broadcasting, obviously very serious events, but it's one thing to keep people glued and sort of hyped up. So how do you talk about this within your circles of meteorologists, within your colleagues, compared to the way that we hear about them talked about in the news?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think most meteorologists are just concerned about saving lives and property. And so as I've been monitoring my colleagues in social media, most of us have a pit in our stomach and feel sick because we have this knowledge of what is about to be a life-altering event for many people in several states. And so all that we can do is convey the best information with the best models and the best satellite information we have. And it's frankly pretty good. And we have to get people to act on it and not be skeptical. I mean, we have no vested interest in hyping this storm. We're just trying to save people's lives.
Well, of course, we do sometimes get mixed messages. We get storm alerts, warnings to evacuate, running 24/7. But then we also have the television reporters hanging on to signposts in harm's way. What's the message there?
Well, I can't sort of speak for sort of why people do those things. But again, the majority of meteorologists, 93%, I'm the former president of the American Meteorological Society, are not sort of in that part of the line of work. We're in the part of the work that's sort of in the trenches trying to provide the best warning information. And so I think that's what the majority of my colleagues do. And I just ask that listeners follow trusted sources and watch for trusted information, because this is a dangerous event.
Well, as you're watching it, this was upgraded for a couple of days ago, a Category 2 storm yesterday, Category 3, Category 4. What does that mean when you're watching that kind of ascension?
Yeah, and I think that's an important lesson for this event and other weather events, frankly. Don't take a forecast that you hear on Monday and assume that's what it'll be on Thursday. I always talk about watching the evolving forecast, because these are very dynamic weather situations. And so our models were hinting all along that this was going to be more intense. And some of the forecasts actually tend to be conservative because they are very aware of not wanting to sound overhyped. But in fact, we knew that this storm was probably going to get to major. Now, Cat 4, that was a bit of a surprise to us, but we thought it would at least get to Category 3.
Well, and I think a lot of people think the wind is the danger if it's a Cat 4 storm or a Cat 2 storm. But it is the water and the storm surges that actually end up killing people. Are those getting worse as our, especially the structure of our coasts change?
Well, I think that water has always been traditionally the most deadly aspect of a hurricane, and we certainly saw that recently with Hurricane Florence and last year with Harvey. But I will say that for this particular storm, I still think the wind damage is going to be particularly problematic because there's so many trees and forested areas in that part of Florida. I went to college at Florida State University, so very familiar with that area. So there's going to be a lot of downed trees, a lot of wind damage. But then, of course, as you noted, the storm surge is going to be historic in that part of the panhandle of Florida.
What could the storm of this size do for agriculture along southwest Georgia, especially?
As I mentioned, I went to Florida State, so I've driven between Tallahassee and Atlanta many times, and there's quite a bit of agriculture, peanuts, cotton, all types of things. And this is harvest season, so I do fear significant agricultural impact, not only from the wind, but the rain as well.
Marsha, late October is traditionally the end of the hurricane season in the southeast. Is that still true?
Oh, sure, it's still true, but if all you have to do is think back to 2005. Certainly hurricanes can go well past the sort of end of the season. We've seen that many times. Not saying that will be the case this year, but perhaps.
Well, you began tracking storms that are way out in the ocean that maybe generate in the Sahara Desert. How many of them actually turn into storms, and how many turn to not?
Very few, actually. Hurricanes are still on the relative scale rare events. I mean, you have many of these sort of clusters of clouds that come off the African coast. Oh, by the way, I should mention that we still are watching. There's a hurricane and storm Nadine out there right now, and there's still another storm that we've been watching for a while, I believe Leslie, that's out there in the Atlantic as well, that actually may head towards Europe. So it's really interesting that we've had such an active October. Typically, September is the most active month.
Is the frequency of extreme weather events increasing in your lifetime as a meteorologist?
Well, it depends on which extreme event you're talking about. I mean, I was on a National Academy of Sciences study a few years ago. Certain events we see, the question is, are they becoming more frequent or becoming more intense? For some events, absolutely. In a climate changed environment or world, we know that from a physics standpoint, hurricanes, when they happen, will be tapping into warmer water and pushing higher sea level. But whether that means more of them, we don't have the science to say that. But when they do happen, and they may actually be more intense because they're running on higher octane fuel, that warmer water.
Okay, so before we close, we'll get to you, Gwen. After storms, any particular way that you should take care of your pets after evacuating?
Yes. Again, I always recommend making sure that you have enough food medication on hand for your pet for several days at least, whether that's in your home if you're riding out the storm, or certainly to bring with you to a shelter. A lot of times, animal rescue organizations in the aftermath of a storm will have supplies on hand, but you shouldn't necessarily count on that, especially if your cat or dog has a restricted diet or other special needs. And again, really, microchipping is I'm going to keep hitting this point because it really is just the easiest and best thing that you can do to make sure if you are separated from your pet that the two of you are reunited. Certainly check in with rescue organizations. A lot of times they'll put pictures on social media to help people reunite with pets.
Gwen Cooper, thank you so much for joining us. Gwen's forthcoming book is My Life in a Cat House, sharing the story of her experience with her three cats during 9/11. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also, Marshall Shepard, keep safe out there. Thank you so much for updating us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And keep you updated throughout the day if you tune into Georgia Public Broadcasting. We want to hear from you. If you're in the path of the hurricane, how are you preparing for the storm? You can call us. You can get us on Facebook or on Twitter. And up next, a new project, Shining a Light on Atlanta Pride. It's on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Atlanta is the epicenter of the gay South. Midtown, Ansley Mall, and Piedmont Park have long been places where LGBTQ folks gathered and created community. A new oral history project reaches back over the decades for stories of LGBTQ people of color in Atlanta and highlights the shifting sites of connectedness across the city. Ashley Coleman-Taylor is an instructor of women's studies at Agnes Scott College and principal investigator for the Black LGBTQ Atlanta Oral History Project. And Ashley, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. And one of the participants and also a contributor, Reverend Duncan Teague from Abundant Life Unitarian Universalist Church in Atlanta, is with us. He has gathered an archive at the Baldwin Ave Research Library and contributed to this project. Welcome, Duncan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Abundant love.
Abundant love. Okay, well, that's even better.
Yeah.
I'll go in for abundant love any day of the week. Ashley, how did you first get involved in this oral history project?
Well, I was a graduate student at Emory University, and I was the assistant program director for a conference that was hosted there called Whose Beloved Community. I was the assistant program director under Charles Stevens, who's also an Oral History Project participant and the executive director of the Counter Narrative Project. I was working up under him, and a professor at Emory actually approached me and kind of asked me if I would be interested in starting an oral history project. The idea around it was a bit different, and so I shifted it a bit and made it kind of an Atlanta, very place-based project with activists.
How far back does it go?
Oh, it goes back. So it's been in the works for about 3 years now.
I mean, in terms of dates, like how far back do you go in the history?
Oh, so I have stories from as early as around 70, in the 70s. As far as queer stories about Atlanta, but of course oral histories go back further because the participants are kind of telling their life stories and they're talking about, you know, when they first discovered who they were. They talk about coming out. They talk about their family histories or histories in the South.
Well, and you're in the research phase still, so we're not authorized to play any audio. But I'm wondering if any stories come to mind that illustrate what drew LGBTQ people of color to Atlanta.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I actually have a story about a woman who's actually from Atlanta. She's kind of remained here and remained a prominent activist in the community. But she told me this story about a club on Cheshire Bridge called Numbers in the 70s that she heard about and really wanted to visit. In the beginning, she thought she was bisexual and started to and wanted to kind of explore her sexuality and would go to Numbers, you know, every weekend, get out of the car, walk up to the door, sweat profusely, start to shake, go back to the van and, you know, get in the car and go home, right? One day, this kind of happened a few times. She went back home. Her sister-in-law was there and kind of asked, like, what's going on? Like, did you go in? What are you doing here? And her sister-in-law then said, you know, no, we're going back. I'm taking you back. So she followed her in her van, got out the car, walked her inside the club, sat there with her, got a drink, and she said to her, you know, like, are you okay? Are you good? And so she's like, yeah. And so she got up and left. Sister-in-law got up and left. She ended up staying for a while and dancing with a woman in the club. They ended up going to her van. And at that point, she kind of proclaims in the oral history, I found out at that point that I was not bisexual. It's just all these kind of stories of becoming, all of these stories of kind of finding oneself, finding one's sexuality. And I'm finding actually a lot of stories around clubs and around these sites of remembrance.
Right.
And
those were places where people could gather.
Absolutely. Sites of community.
Yeah. So, now, Duncan, for you, you moved to Atlanta in the 80s. Where'd you come from?
Kansas City, Missouri.
So what brought you here?
I was coming here to celebrate my recent graduation from college. And my dear friend and cousin, Tony, sent for me. And he offered me a 2-free-week vacation, but he also had a plan in mind. And so in that 2 weeks that I arrived, it was the perfect 2 weeks for me to come. So the Sunday of the second week was Labor Day weekend, which is now considered Black Gay Pride. But back then, it was just Labor Day in Atlanta, but a whole lot of African-American gay and lesbian folks would come in town. And so that Sunday I was at a picnic at Henri McTerry's backyard, and I thought it was just going to be a regular picnic. And when I arrived, there were like more than 200 men in his backyard partying, and they were some of the best looking, most, you know, urban and urbane looking men, and they were all like dressed to the nines, and we were having a wonderful
time. And you were
time.
Not in and Kansas City
I
anymore.
I was not in Kansas City anymore. I thought that every black gay person in America was in that backyard.
Well, you started work with AID Atlanta a few years later. So the first black gay outreach worker with that organization. Now, this was, of course, the 80s, a devastating time eventually for the community.
And AID Atlanta was two full-time employees and four part-time, I think, back then.
So this was a transformational point, of course, the AIDS crisis. You know, after Stonewall, one of those big markers in the gay community, after Pride started being celebrating. So that has changed, obviously, so much in the community. Ashley, what are the kind of stories and things that you were hearing from that time that make you think about that transformation and how important it was?
Well, I remember having a conversation with Duncan, actually, after we did his oral history, and we were talking specifically about a black gay club on kind of the west side of Atlanta and talking about what it meant for black gay folks in that era to be in the club. And I remember him saying to me, which is still resonates with me, he said, we were dancing for our lives, particularly because you didn't know who was going to be there the next week, right? You know, communities were being decimated. And there's a moment, particularly when you gather, you dine together, you eat together, you share stories. Yeah. There are these particular moments of connectivity that really demonstrate the power of what it means to be black, queer, and in Atlanta.
And in community. I mean, I'm thinking that the experience for race obviously adds a real dimension to these stories, especially in the South. So, Duncan, for you, what are some of the differences that you've observed between the experiences of a black LGBTQ Atlantan over the years and their white counterparts?
One is that when I arrived in the 80s, socially, especially, Atlanta was still segregated. And there were those of us who crossed, you know, over into different parts of the queer Atlanta world. But a lot of African-American gay and lesbian folks, rightly so, were comfortable in their own settings and navigating the world as they needed to and had to in our own places. And so as the epidemic hit our community and folks didn't want to own it, we became our own support networks, our own sources of support. I'm not saying that the white gay community abandoned us or didn't do anything with us. That's not necessarily true. But for so many folks, and in particular because of racism, it was just more comfortable to do whatever you needed to with folks who you loved and trust. So and remember, in the earliest days of the epidemic, we didn't even know how it was passed.
Right.
And there was no medication, and you didn't know how long you had. And so the love and care you got were from people who were nearest you.
Right.
And you might not have ever thought about coming out to your family. And you certainly didn't want to come out to them about having a devastating illness.
Yeah. So devastating and unifying
and
at the same time.
And I have to also say that because of the visceral attack on our very lives, it also fueled some of the most amazing organizing and art and cultural developments in our community.
That's the Reverend Duncan Teague from Abundant Love Unitarian Universalist Church. Also with me, Ashley Coleman Taylor. She's a principal investigator for the Black LGBT Atlanta Oral History Project.
Well, you mentioned, Ashley, the clubs. You know, this is a big part of it. But, of course, neighborhoods. And traditionally, you know, it's in transforming neighborhoods that people who are considered to be on the margins find their place. Gentrification has changed so many Atlanta neighborhoods over the years. How has that affected the LGBTQ neighborhoods in particular?
Well, I do want to say, I think that it's a misconception that there were kind of LGBTQ black neighborhoods specifically, right? So you have Midtown that's kind of always been a hub for queer folks. But it was predominantly white, mm-hmm. right? So as far as black communities, we've always lived amongst everybody else, right? So there were not these like black queer communities per se. The community would be found again at these events, at people's homes, at meetings, at organizing meetings, right? So, but I will say that we can think about Midtown in particular and how at one point there were around 40 clubs, right, and in Midtown alone, and just even the stories that that the participants have told me about Midtown and about how which clubs were there, where people would connect, where people would meet each other. And a lot of those places are gone now.
Yeah, are still there.
And it's kind of cleaning up of the city, right? And kind of the attempt to kind of rebrand the city. Oftentimes what happens is you have marginalized communities being pushed out and being moved out. And this means people of color. This means people who might not have the type of finances that other communities have. This means poor people. This means those who are transient in the city are kind of continuously being moved, pushed out. And I do want to say the Oral History Project is an attempt to push back against the gentrification and the erasure of these communities. So while this is kind of rapidly occurring in the city, this process of gentrification and moving communities out, this Oral History Project is an attempt to it's an attempt to locate these sites of remembrance. It's an attempt to also tell the stories of love and friendship and tell the life histories of people who have been based in this city. So it offers a counter narrative to this kind of fast-paced erasure that's going on. I'm an Atlanta native. I've been here my whole life, born and raised, college, grad school. I love the city. This is also, not only is it a kind of a powerful project in its own right, but it's also, you know, my gift back to my community. This is also, I'm building an archive and allowing stories to be able to live together so that future generations can know that people were here doing the work and have been here doing the work. And they were not the first. They won't be the last. So this is kind of building a kind of archive of, this is about building an archive, building a collection of the stories that can live together to tell the story of the city, a counter narrative to
the progress and the moving forward and the development.
This is who gets left behind, right? Like, you have to think about who gets left behind. Yes, we want Atlanta to be this great hub as it has been for years, but we also have to think about, like, in with said progress, who oftentimes gets left behind.
So it's a form of preservation.
Absolutely.
In many ways. Well, Duncan, we're going to have to wrap in a break for in just a minute, but I'm wondering about, for you, you gathered these stories for a long time and contributed your archive to Ashley's project. So how has conducting these oral histories, gathering those kind of stories, changed you as a person hearing them?
It's changed me because I literally had boxes of stuff. And my husband was getting a little fed up with how many boxes of stuff. And also friends who are academics and what have you, I would show them the things and they go, Duncan, you've got to put this where it's going to be used by other folks. So one of the things, it has been flattering to be called an archivist when actually I'm a collector of stuff who gave it to institutions like the Auburn Avenue Research Library, where people who are doing the research, like Ashley and other academics and just people who want to find out what happened can go there and look through those flyers, those pictures, those documents that say we existed and we were actually working not just partying all the time. We had rich, full lives. And it's also personally sort of healing to sort of bring some of my friends back with their stories and with their documents.
Ashley, quickly, when will these be available or will they be available to the public in the future?
Yes, absolutely. They'll be available. They should be available in about the next 6 months.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Glad to hear it. Ashley Coleman-Taylor, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ashley is an instructor of women's studies at Agnes Scott College and the principal investigator for the Black LGBT Atlanta Oral History Project. Reverend Duncan Teague, thank you so much.
Thank you.
From the Abundant Love Unitarian Universalist Church. Up next, a highly selective field guide picks out some essential things to see and know about the new American South. We're going to find out what those are after the break. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. You may not think of the South as the cradle of multiculturalism, but we are giving that a second thought on tomorrow's show. In the mid-20th century, influential white and black writers and intellectuals argued against integration. They advocated for separate cultural and creative spaces coexisting on parallel tracks. So, separate, but equal? What do you say? What did integration mean for black and white culture? And did fears that black music and food and slang would be mixed or eroded or co-opted or ruin white culture? Did that come true? Chime in on Facebook or Twitter or call us at 404-500-9457 and join us live tomorrow at 9. But for now, we turn to the South decades after integration, a place of unbearable tensions, as Taylor Bruce writes in his introduction to American South. It's the latest field guide in the Wild Sam American Road Trip series. Taylor's creator and editor of the series and joins us now from Austin. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So Wild Sam, not your typical field guide. Very designed. We don't get starred ratings and photographs of places you must see.
But right.
Instead, we get old news clippings and stories and recommendations for travelers. Tell me a little bit about this. You were a travel writer for 8 years before this guide. What was the inspiration?
So the inspiration really was to create a book that really tells you where you are. You know, I mean, Google can tell you kind of where you land on the map, but doesn't really give you the depth of context. And so we felt like there was a need for guides that told the story of a place. And so I was living in a 500-square-foot apartment in New York City and had just finished an MFA in fiction writing and just had this idea and gathered some friends up in Nashville, Tennessee, and a good friend in Atlanta who's a designer. And, you know, 6 months later, we had a book about Nashville, and that was 6 years ago, and we're on our 13th book now.
Right. And so this one is The American South, and you write in your introduction, oppression and guilt, death and life, beauty and sorrow. Because this is my home and these are my people, I cannot escape these two stories. They're like two trees wrapped together on my family farm. What are these two stories?
You know, the South, you know this and you discuss it on your show. It is a complicated place. It is dark and light, as I say in the intro. And The two stories are, you know, they're sort of inescapable. If you just, you know, a typical travel guide, for example, is going to mostly tell one story, which is, you know, this great restaurant and this beautiful beach and that type of experience. And we just feel that to have a full experience and sort of a complete picture of humanity, you have to tell the whole story. And that includes the darker truths. And so all of our books in the American South, for sure, kind of takes that head on and doesn't shy away from telling those stories. And and letting other people tell those stories. We sort of see ourselves as kind of the congregating force that brings other voices into the book and just sort of lets the stories be themselves.
And you write about coming across a story in particular that revealed some of this darker truth. You're there in Austin and read something in the New York Times about your hometown, LaGrange, Georgia. What was that?
Yeah, I grew up, just about an hour south of Atlanta in LaGrange, and an amazing town. Love LaGrange. And this is, January 2017. I pick up the newspaper, and on the front page, below the fold, there was the headline, "White Police Chief Apologizes for 1940 Southern Lynching." And it's the story of a young man, a teenage black teenager who was accused of attacking a white woman, and a mob of white men took him from the jail and drove him 8 miles outside of town and killed him. And I had never heard that story. The first I read of it was that morning in the newspaper. And that the story itself was a shocking truth, but to realize that I had, I'd grown up for 18 years in this town and had never heard this story. And, my parents had never heard this story. And I would wager to say most of the people I know had never heard this story. It said a lot to me about sort of the South and, that the light of truth is sort of not shown everywhere. Ida B. Wells writes that the only way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. And so, that experience it really sort of said and sort of inspired me to just kind of move right into my home place and to do this book.
Mm, so inside of a place we don't often see the truth, sometimes we have to get away. And in the beginning of the book, there are different points in Southern history, which, of course, is a rich and vast history, beginning with 1513, Ponce de Leon, or Ponce de Leon, as we say here in Atlanta, explores mythical waters in Florida. But some really interesting other dates, of course, the Civil War. But then, we have things like Roots, the miniseries airs on ABC. Recall opens Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals. Why these choices? What makes them the markers of Southern history?
Our books are small. If you were holding it in your hand, you could put it in your back pocket. It's 140 pages, and it's not an exhaustive story of the South, but our hope is that we will sort of sprinkle on every page these sort of beautiful and true stories about the region that just spark people's curiosity to discover and learn more and to experience, to go to Muscle Shoals and sort of, have a moment of understanding what happened in Fame Studios, and or to go on the Georgia coast and see the shrimp boats in Darien. And we're not going to sort of give you 100 restaurants to eat at. It's more of, hey, there's this one restaurant in Atlanta, Busy Bee Cafe. Like, if you go there, you're going to experience something real about the city, and it's special. And so that's kind of our approach. And, our timeline is on one page. And so obviously you can't capture the history of the South. You can't capture the history of anywhere on a single page. So,
but it is interesting to do, through the books and the food and the literature and even right. the television shows in some way. I'm speaking with the writer, editor, and LaGrange native Taylor Bruce. He's the curator of the Wild Sam Field Guides, which recently published a field guide to the American South, including Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And this is one of the songs that came from there. Aretha Franklin, of course, her career transformed in Muscle Shoals. Many things have transformed in the South. And this guide, the Wild Sam Guide, sends readers on this two-week trip called the Southern Epic. This is from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans. And in Georgia, you suggest people stop in Atlanta, specifically the Buford Highway. What makes this the destination?
It was really tough to figure out what is one thing that people should experience in Atlanta. And we landed on the Buford Highway. If you're unfamiliar, it's a 10-mile stretch of just global cuisine. And with all these restaurants, it really felt like a picture of the New South, that it is truly a melting pot, and it's a beautiful picture of, you know, where the South is headed. Obviously food in the South is something special, and so we just felt like, you know, that was a bit of a surprise and not necessarily what people would expect, but such a unique experience and emblematic of the good things happening in the region.
And there are so many stories. One quirky one I would love to ask you about is Jimmy Carter's UFO story from 1973. Can you summarize that tale for us?
Yeah, so there's a section in the book we call the Almanac, and we love to find old newspaper articles that just give sort of a slice of, you know, a moment in time. And when President Carter was campaigning in 1973, this was in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He saw a UFO, and he's quoted, you know, describing, you know, it was about 30 degrees above the horizon, looked about as large as the moon. It got smaller and changed to a reddish color, and then got larger again. I mean, this is the future president of the United States talking about seeing a UFO. And President Carter is just, he's a great example of what I love about the South. You know, he's a nuclear submariner from a peanut farm. You know, it's just that combination of high and low is just one of my favorite things about, you know, Georgia and the South at large. It's just a beautiful combination.
There's also a story. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, that section I was flipping through earlier, there's a section about Herschel Walker when he was being recruited as a high school running back. And there's a small bit about Channing Cope, who was a kudzu evangelist in the 1940s, you know, the miracle plan of kudzu, telling everyone to plant it everywhere. Thanks a lot. And so it's just, we sort of see when you sort of just put a bunch of these stories together in a bit of a, you know, a gumbo that people, that it just, it colors the region in a really interesting way and fun, you know, like we said, light and dark, you know, those two things together create more of a more complete picture of place.
Well, and we get a complete picture from there's an essay by Nicole Hannah Jones, Ghosts of Greenwood. She's describing returning to Greenwood, Mississippi, a place her grandmother left during Jim Crow, 50 years after the Freedom Summer. So the guy doesn't duck the ugly truths or the hard truths. So did you feel in your way, you know, as you're writing a book and a guide to the American South, what is the responsibility to get the South right, if I can say that?
I feel a huge responsibility. It's
how do you do it?
Well, you don't do it alone is one thing. So you bring in, you know, people like Nicole, who are incredible writers and deeply thoughtful, and Brian Stevenson is an interview in the book, and you know Brian is a hero of ours, and the way that he is approaching, you know, the history of lynching in the South in Montgomery is incredible, and you know, interviewing people like Brian and Chef Frank Stitt and bringing in writers like Nicole, we feel like the more voices that are in the book, the better chance we have of getting it quote unquote right, and if it's true. We feel like we're going to get close, you know, to that moment of being right. But you know, this book, it's 140 pages, and you could do 10 versions of it and change every story, and it still wouldn't capture the entire place. And so our hope is that we capture an essence that feels real and authentic, and that sparks curiosity and you know, gives some people a moment to reflect on, you know, what this place is and what their place might be in it. You know, we're all complex beings and stories upon stories upon stories. So hopefully the book kind of points people in that direction.
And you're going to make a lot of people mad if you choose the wrong barbecue place, obviously.
I know. Yeah, we try not to do too much claiming of best in the region. But we have there's a meet and three section in the book where we list our 15 favorite meet and threes across the South. And, you know, there were a lot of good ones that didn't make the list, too.
It's also divided into sections. You've got cities and towns. You mentioned almanacs, the road trips, the interviews, the stories, some of the essentials. But you also highlight some issues, upward mobility, mass incarceration, and in rural parts of the South, you know, many people view travel as an escape from the real world. So why establish these points?
You know, it's that whole part about trying to get to the whole picture. You know, Brian, when we were interviewing Brian Stephen, he said something to me that I'll never forget. He said that having proximity to inequality awakens something in a just society. And, you know, when we share the harder parts of a place, a city or a region, the challenges, the issues, the problems that are unsolved, and I just feel like it's gonna open up that place in a real way. And it's like if you're getting to know a person, if you have a friend and all they share is the good things from their resume, you're not really gonna know them. But if they share their fuller story and their struggles and their past, that's when a depth of friendship starts. And we kind of approach a place the same way. I love when I have a better context, a deeper understanding of a place. The place comes alive in a different way.
Well, this is, of course, we've said, you know, American South, vast, complex, layers of meaning for different people. But in a way, you are establishing with this guide an essential South. No small task. So what kind of questions did you ask editorially and with your counterparts working on this about taking on the whole South?
I mean, lots of questions. You know, I think the biggest question for us was, what's the balance of the hard things and the beautiful things, and how do you present that true picture in a way that doesn't feel heavy-handed in either direction? And it's kind of a touch and feel thing. It feels a little bit like music, you know. In my ear, it sounded right. You know, when we got to a point that we felt like it was complete, and you know, other people obviously were sort of a part of the editorial process too. And our hope was that whether you grew up in the South and have lived there your entire life, or you're coming in from, you know, from London and have never stepped foot in Georgia, that this book would speak to you in a way that felt honest and inspired you to go deeper and go further really see the place for what it is.
Okay, so now we're going to call you out on, you have not yet done a guide on any particular town in Georgia. So what's happening here, Taylor?
When's you know, gonna... so Atlanta, I was looking back. So there's several things in Atlanta. We talk about several restaurants, Beaufort Highway. We interviewed several people from Atlanta. But we knew in our back pocket that there's an Atlanta city guide coming. It's, you know, there's several cities in the U.S. that we're really excited about. Chicago, Portland, and Atlanta is right there.
How about Savannah? We got to stand up for Savannah.
I know. Savannah is great. Athens is an awesome town. It's coming for sure.
Well, you do begin the book with the lyrics to this song, which actually was not written originally as a song, or maybe it have been, but this is Claude Ely in 1934, "There Ain't No Grave Can Hold My Body Down." Why start with that?
You know, at the beginning of the book, there's what we call the welcome, and it's a one-page intro that I write. It's the very last thing I do for these books, and it's kind of a culmination. And I really was struggling with this one. I wrestled for a couple weeks on what I would say, and there was a writer that we had been in contact with, John Jeremiah Sullivan, as we worked on the book, and I texted John the morning I was trying to get this thing done, and I said, "John, I need a song to sort of get in the headspace. What's the one song I need to be listening to right now?" And he told me this song, and so I put it on repeat, and it really sort of brought a lot of things up in my mind, including the story of Austin Calaway from my hometown, and you know,
Taylor,
the intro came.
We're going to let that music play, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
I appreciate it.
Taylor Bruce, LaGrange native and creator of the Wild Sam Field Guides, the Wild Sam Field Guide for the American South, is now available.